Merci, Monsieur le Président. Je suis très content d'être ici. Content toujours de partager la parole avec mon ami Gabriella et d'être encore une fois à Montréal, une ville que j'ai visitée pour la première fois en 1967 pour l'ouverture de l'exposition mondiale.
I think, however, that the thoughts that I have to share with you today are sufficiently subtle that I had perhaps be well advised to retreat to the language of Texas. For several decades now, I have been engaged with cohorts of my students, actually, in a project that attempts to define the extent and specific character of the rise and sometimes decline of inequalities, of economic inequalities in the global economy. And I think we have contributed to that enterprise and to that project, which was of, when we began, only minor interest to the economics profession, in a fairly significant way. And one of the things that has been a consistent feature of the results of that research is, again, a project of measurement and of geographic and industrial sectoral definition of what's behind the rise of inequality. One of the things that has stood out for us is that it is consistently the fact that in the age of financial globalization, the rise of inequality is driven by finance and by the increasing importance and dominance of the financial sector. Excuse me, moving ahead here. And secondly, in particular when one looks at the advanced countries, the second factor, which is closely allied with the influence of the financial sector, is the rise of the technology sector. The technology sector tends to be of great significance for the increase of inequality because it is the sector that has what one might call Schumpeterian power in the economy. It's the sector which has been driving the structural changes that we have all experienced. And in this process, the relatively small firms that emerge in the dominant role in the technology sector come to share a disproportionate share of the total income. And it turns out that both of these sectors are geographically very concentrated. They're very concentrated in the United States on the coasts, finance primarily in the east, technology primarily in the west. And you can see this very clearly if you map out the evolution of economic inequality in the United States. What's this got to do, then, with populism? I want to associate myself very largely with what Gabriela Ramos just said, with the general analysis of the evolution of social facts in our societies. But populism is a political phenomenon, and so to understand it and to understand exactly what the issue is, one has to be quite specific about how one defines populism, and one has to appreciate it through the lens, if you like, or the framework of the political structure of each society. And so if one takes, and I'm going to take, for example, the I don't think you can see that all the well, but it's a familiar map of the election campaign that we just experienced in the United States. Certainly a very interesting time to be an American citizen, I have to tell you that. A bit like the sack of Rome by Alaric or other phenomena. It has a very distinct geographic dimension. Now, we can define the campaign, if not the administration, of the candidate who came out on top, that's Mr. Trump, as a populist campaign. It had a very strong element of, let's say, amplified anger at the evolution of economic life in the United States. And that element was, in a sense, mobilizing for a substantial part of the working class, the industrial working classes in the United States, particularly white industrial working classes, who have a particular geographic distribution. It was, from a cultural standpoint, it had strong gendered and racial elements, but it was also very strongly a repudiation of rule by the professional classes, and an assertion that direct rule by the oligarchs, which we are now experiencing, you could look at the list of Mr. Trump's cabinet members, is preferable to being ruled by people who merely have academic or scientific or other professional credentials, people like me, for example. Well, I've never been involved. I've never been that close to power. I'm associated with all the losing campaigns of the last 50 years. But you know what I'm talking about. People with the same sort of credentials but slightly less renegade than myself. So then one should ask, is there a statistical relationship between the rise of inequality and the evolution of voting patterns in the United States, given the fact that presidential elections in the United States are decided at the level of the state, not at the level of the country as a whole. It's not a popular vote outcome. It is an outcome which is winner-take-all at the level of individual states, as expressed through the Electoral College. And if I think this audience is like other audiences to whom I've posed this question recently, I think you would all give the same answer. Yes, in those states where inequality has gone up the most, you would expect the strongest populist reaction against rising inequality. Right? And so that would be, the common sense of the matter. The common sense of the matter, as it turns out, is exactly wrong, as common sense rarely is, but in this case, it's not the way the data pan out. To examine what actually happened, one has to have measures of inequality at the level of the American state, 50 states plus the District of Columbia. And there is a problem with that, which is to go back over 50 or 60 years, one has a deficiency of effective data. Inequality at the state level is only measured accurately before 2000 at 10-year intervals of the decennial census, because the current population survey is too small a sample to pick up and effectively measure the smallest states. So something had to be done to remedy that before one could ask the question in a clear-cut manner. And that was a task that my students took on. Using other data sources, we were able to develop, very accurate annual measures of inequality in the American states going back to 1969, which permits us to ask the question, how much did inequality rise in the different states of the United States, and was that degree of increase associated with the election outcome of 2016? Let me see if I can figure out which direction. I'm afraid the color scheme on your projector is not effective, but we're saved by the shapes of the markers. Here's a plot of the of two things. One, on the horizontal axis, is the proportionate change in inequality. This is measured as inequality in pay. Inequality in income is a substantially similar phenomenon. And on the vertical axis, the share of votes going to Hillary Clinton in the last election. The diamonds are states that she won. They're in blue. And the circles are states that were won by Donald Trump. They're in red. And what you can see is very clear. And I think from the standpoint of social science statistics, quite a remarkable finding. The 14 states with the largest increases in inequality from 1990 to 2016, which is 2014, so to say, almost a quarter of a century period, the 14 states with the largest increases in inequality, every single one of those states was carried by Hillary Clinton in the last election. The states toward the origin, toward the bottom right, from my point of view, of this diagram, the states with the circles, which were carried by Donald Trump, had the smallest increases in inequality. So it's a counterintuitive phenomenon, but it suggests the relationship between the growth of inequality and political formations in the United States. What happens in the large states, and I think I have them by, yes, I have them by, with the states labeled here. So you can see California and out to the far right, New York, Connecticut, New Jersey, California and Maryland, and then Hawaii and Massachusetts, and Rhode Island and Nevada, states with distinct and substantial increases in inequality, are the states which vote for the Democratic candidate. And they are states where you have a palpable alliance between the rich and the poor, between the wealthy professionals who dominate the major industries and sectors of those states, and the substantially minority and heavily immigrant communities, which form the base of the Democratic Party. And where those two forces are substantially in majority, you have a state that's going to vote for the Democrats. In the states where neither of those forces is substantially important, in particular states which are dominated by declining white, mainly white industrial communities, and African American cities like Detroit or major parts of Milwaukee, which are in demographic decline and also subject to substantial repression of the vote, you have states which are in the control of the Republican Party. And that's true of the smaller states of the plains. It's true of the states of the Deep South. It's also true that you have in this phenomenon a group of states that are in the middle, which are contestable. And there are, I think, for the future of the relationship between populism and inequality, an interesting phenomena going on. The states of the industrial Midwest are moving in the direction of the Republican states for demographic and industrial reasons. They are not becoming more contestable, but rather less so. The states of the South, North Carolina, Georgia, Texas, Arizona, South and Southwest, are demographically and industrially moving in the direction of the Democrats. And this was Texas was an interesting state where the Democratic vote for Hillary Clinton was substantially greater than it had been 4 years ago for Barack Obama. So you can see this phenomenon already underway in a place which could eventually be the tipping point once again of American politics. So while there is, it seems to me, a very distinct relationship between populism and inequality, if one defines populism in the Trumpist sense, the political evolution of that relationship suggests that more inequality will generate less populism or less successful populism. And if you don't like that conclusion, we better reinvent the political structure of the countries that we're dealing with. Is this also true in other countries? Well, here's the Brexit vote. Again, I'm sorry for the lack of drama in the projection of this particular slide. But it tells you very clearly that in that vote, it was a division of the regions, of particularly of England and Wales, as between the relatively wealthy, extremely wealthy city of London and the south of England, and the more depressed north and north country and in the Midlands, which voted overwhelmingly or strongly, in East Anglia, which voted strongly for Brexit. And that, again, was an expression of Trumpist populism, if you like. Interesting phenomenon in Britain, of course, and I didn't have time to create a map of, or to collect a map of it, I don't know if it's available yet, is that the more recent election, which showed a very different political outcome, that is to say, the rise of Jeremy Corbyn and the decline of conservatives, suggests, once again, confirming my hypothesis, that a progressive alliance actually has its political outreach and its political base not in the poorer regions of the country, but in the richer ones. It was the rise of Labour in London, but also in places like Kent and Canterbury, Tory districts in the south, struck what's called the stockbroker belt, that made a substantial part of the difference in depriving Theresa May of her majority just a week ago. And I gather the political drama that has unleashed is not over yet and probably won't be over for some time. It may well lead to another election in which these trends will have an opportunity to be even more firmly expressed. And one can go, again, the moment has been superseded by a later election, but this is the distribution of the votes between Macron and Le Pen in the second round of the French presidential elections. And you can see the blue are the National Front areas, and the red are the non-National Front areas, the consolidation of all other forces that handed Macron his decisive victory. But even if you go back to the first round, you will see that the very distinct element here is the strong concentration of votes that lie in the, let's say, the orbit of professional government in the Parisian region, which is obviously one of the richest in Europe and one of the richest in the world, and the concentration of the extreme right populist votes in the depressed industrial sectors. So how these patterns play out depends very much, is I think broadly in line with the ideas that Gabriella expressed, but reflect their particularly geographic character insofar as people tend to vote for candidates of distress and disillusion, not so much when they themselves are impoverished, but when they live in regions which they feel to be deeply neglected and which are losing population to other centers where economic opportunity is so much greater than it is there. And it is, I think, the drama of the Democratic Party, of the French Socialist Party, and until just now of the British Labour Party, that it operated a political regime which failed to recognize this reality effectively and failed to devote the kinds of resources, whatever they may be, to pursuing a kind of balanced development, thereby allowing large parts of their geographic base to disintegrate and to become prey to the kinds of shall we say, both irresponsible and dangerous appeals that were made by Donald Trump or by Marine Le Pen, and one can say by the Brexit, and by Nigel Farage, for that matter, by the Brexit tears in the United Kingdom. So that's my message. It's just a little more complicated, perhaps, than we thought, but one which I hope is of some interest to you. Merci beaucoup.